Today at Reader's Corner, William Droziak, author of Fractured Continent, Europe's Crises and the Fate of the West. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. With more than 500 million citizens in its 28 member states, the European Union has long embodied the dream of a unified Europe, where the free movement of goods, capital, services, and workers would lead to greater economic and political clout for all. But in recent years, the fissures within the EU have deepened. The Syrian refugee crisis, the economic downturn, a spate of terrorist attacks, and the Greek financial bailouts have roiled the EU. And then came Brexit, the decision by British voters to exit the European Union, much to the surprise and consternation of the many observers who expected the referendum to fail. A new book by William Droziak, titled Fractured Continent, Europe's Crises and the Fate of the West, offers valuable and timely insights on the complex issues facing the European Union. In the book, Mr. Droziak transports us to London, Madrid, Paris, Copenhagen, and other EU capitals and offers an insider's perspective on the challenges these countries face. Mr. Droziak has a long and distinguished career working in Europe, including 2 decades as a senior editor and foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. He was the founding executive editor of the Transatlantic Center in Brussels, Belgium, and he served for 10 years as the president of the American Council on Germany. Mr. Droziak is currently a fellow at the Brookings Institution and a senior advisor on Europe to an international strategic consultancy firm based in Washington, D.C. He joins us today by phone for this interview. Bill Droziak, welcome to Reader's Corner.
My pleasure, Bob.
You know, Bill, so often when I'm talking basketball here at Boise State, I lament the fact that our players, after they use up their eligibility and graduate, instead of going on for a real job, they head for Europe to play basketball because they have difficulty getting into the NBA. And I always lament that, like, why don't these guys realize they're not going to get to the NBA and why don't they get a real job? Well, I take it all back after reading the acknowledgments in your book and how you became this expert on Europe and spent so many years there affecting your life and career, even your marriage. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, Bob, I graduated from University of Oregon in 1971, and I played on a great team. We had 3 players who got drafted in the NBA. I was drafted by the Golden State Warriors, but unfortunately, I didn't fit in with their plans, so my agent found me a job playing basketball in Europe, and it sounded like a nice adventure. And I went. I played in Italy, Spain, France, and ended up in Belgium, where I did my graduate studies. And eventually made the transition after 6 years of playing in Europe to journalism, because I like to write, and I figured being a foreign correspondent would give me the same kind of excitement of travel and adventure that playing basketball had done. So I was very fortunate that I was able to make that rather unusual transition.
Well, it's all led to what I think is one of the most timely and important books on international relations and especially, of course, the European arena. Perhaps you could comment. I believe you say in your book that 2016 was somewhat of a watershed year in the sense that Europe may be enduring its greatest existential crisis in 70 years.
Well, there were actually several crises that sort of came together like a perfect storm with several different forces merging as one. And it was it began with the financial crisis, which really Europe hadn't recovered since 2008, and it threatened to blow up the European single currency, the Eurozone, because Greece had run up so many debts that they simply couldn't pay them. The country is about to go insolvent and was going to be forced out of the Eurozone, and there was a lot of fear that the whole currency group would break up and go back to national currencies. And then, of course, the exodus of refugees from the Syrian civil war, first into Turkey, and then when they opened the gates from Turkey into Greece, because the Greek islands are only a couple of miles from the Turkish mainland. And when those refugees learned that they might be able to make it to the what they considered the promised land of affluence in Germany and Sweden, so they all rushed for the gates, and And within the span of just a few months, more than a million had poured into Europe. So it was threatening to destabilize Europe with this refugee crisis. And then, of course, the British referendum, which was held in June of that year, and nobody expected that the Brits would vote that way. But there was a bad miscalculation by Prime Minister David Cameron, and when they voted to leave the European Union by 52% to 48%, it came as a real shock. So all of these factors, and then at the same time, there was a growth in popularity of these far-right extremist parties that also threatened to destabilize the democracy. So there was a feeling that Europe had gone too far in trying to expand its ambitions to become a United States of Europe, and the voters were rebelling against this. And then, of course, on the Eastern Front, you had a more belligerent Russia invading Crimea, taking over Crimea and the eastern Ukraine, and that raised fears that they might want to recapture or regain control over the Baltic states. So all of these factors played into what was really an existential crisis, and Europe is still grappling with a lot of these forces. While the economy seems to be recovering, they still have a lot of problems that they have to deal with.
And then I suppose Trump and his election and his questioning of NATO and the Western alliance in Europe, that must also complicate matters.
Right, and that's compounded their crisis. In a way, Trump is seen as sort of an extension of the populist nationalists that are gaining ground in several European countries. And when he started saying, wavering about American commitments, that made many Europeans quake, and they said, well, maybe we can no longer entrust our security to the United States anymore. And so that's now raised questions about what is Europe going to do? How can Germany, France, and other countries align in such a way that they can provide for their own defense? So all of these questions are being wrestled with now. I think the big ray of hope has been the election of Emmanuel Macron, who in the space of 8 months has emerged as a very dynamic global leader. And the hope is that Macron and with perhaps Chancellor Merkel taking on her fourth term in power after 12 years, that kind of tandem would be able to show the kind of leadership that Europe needs.
So much of what is unfolding in crisis across Europe seems to stem from that Syrian conflict that you alluded to, whether it's Greece or whether it's Denmark and they're verging to the right. I just wonder, from what we've read of the Obama administration's decision not to engage in the Syrian civil war, is there much talk in Europe about what could have been if, in fact, the U.S. found a way to engage in the civil war, or is that just really impossible to speculate?
No, well, there's a lot of hand-wringing about the costs of America's retreat from the global stage, and we saw this after the colossal strategic blunders of going in for so many years in Iraq and creating the chaos there that led to the Islamic State and a new wave of terrorism. And then now 17 years in Afghanistan, we don't have much to show for it in terms of preventing the Taliban from regaining power. And I think when Obama came into the White House, he said, enough is enough. The American people are tired of these long, what he called forever wars. And he said, I'm not going to get us embroiled in another conflict. Well, he drew some red lines when Syria's Bashar Assad used chemical weapons against his own people. He said, we will intervene. And then he chose not to, because he didn't want to bring the U.S. into that conflict. And a lot of Europeans say this was a sign that America was abdicating its leadership of the West. If the U.S. had gone in and at least stopped the conflict at that time and enforced some kind of a compromise peace deal, then they wouldn't have been saddled with these millions of refugees who were poured out of Syria. And they're still camped out. There are 3 million who are camped in Turkey, and there are many others who want to get out to Europe. And now they're choosing other routes. So this is a problem that still has not been resolved as long as the Syrian civil war is going on.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with William Droziak, author of Fractured Continent, Europe's Crises and the Fate of the West. Well, one of the Western leaders that certainly didn't back off is Angela Merkel. She clearly opened her arms and opened Germany's arms to Europe's refugee crisis. It gained her international admiration, the cover of Time magazine, 2015 Person of the Year, but one heck of a lot of backlash at home. How is she working to defuse that crisis, and where does she stand today as a result of it?
Well, I think when she made that decision, in fact, I opened the book with the chapter on Berlin and that fateful weekend in September 2015 when she saw these refugees hold up in the Budapest train station, and she said Germany, given its terrible historic past, cannot stand aside and let these refugees suffer. And so she said, let them come in. And she made that decision rather in a bold, even reckless way, which is very much against her nature. She's known as somebody extremely cautious before she takes a decision, takes one small step forward and looks all around, see how people react. Well, in this case, she said, I had no choice. It was a Saturday morning, and I couldn't reach other leaders. And so I decided on that. And there was a great sense of moral vindication. A lot of Germans welcomed that. In fact, they were cheering the refugees as they arrived at the Munich train station. But then the reality sunk in that how are we going to absorb these people after a few weeks? And then after a few months, it started having political repercussions as the populace who were against the immigrants wanted to kick all of them out, started gaining more and more popular support. So now she's taking a much tougher line about how many immigrants can come into Germany. She's even supporting the idea of expelling immigrants who don't have a political persecution case to make. But that didn't help her in the last election. In September, her party came out with its worst score in nearly 40 years. So she's struggling now to put together a coalition government with the Social Democrats, but I believe she's in the twilight phase of her political career. She's been in power 12 years. She's exhausted from dealing with all of these crises. And even if she does manage to pass together this government, I don't think she's going to stay in power much beyond another year or two. Britain is floundering, looking for a new identity, leaving the European Union. And that sort of has put all of the burden of leadership on the shoulders of Emmanuel Macron, who has just turned 40 years old and is the bright young hope among Western democracies. But whether he can succeed or not is still an open question.
So what is the relationship these days between Merkel and Macron?
Well, I think she's very well disposed to him. She's 63, he's 40. It's a different generation. He thinks like the millennial generation. Climate change is a big issue for him. That's why he was outraged by the United States deciding to back out of that treaty. He has taken an active role in trying to mediate peace in the Middle East, not just in Syria, but also between Iran and Saudi Arabia. So in a way, he's juggling a lot of balls already just 8 months into power. But the most important relationship for him will be with Germany. He's chosen several of his leading advisors on the basis of their contacts and knowledge of Germany. And I think that he realizes the key to any relaunch of momentum toward a more united Europe is going to have to come from a close and strong partnership between France and Germany, and that's been missing for the last decade or so. I recount in the book how frustrated Merkel was in dealing with Macron's predecessors, Nicolas Sarkozy and Francois Hollande, And she wanted to share the burdens and responsibilities of power, but they were not up to the job. But she's more hopeful about Macron, even though he is untested and has never held elected office before winning the presidency. So he's a really a blank slate.
So Macron's biggest political nemesis is Le Pen, Marie Le Pen, who, of course, opposed him, ran against him, and lost. But I saw in your book, and this I did not know or understand, that Putin offered $1 million loan to Le Pen's campaign, I believe it was. But if you could comment on this relationship and what that says about Macron's future.
Well, it shows you how devious Russia has been in its efforts to destabilize Western democracies. We, of course, are going through this discussion and even investigation of what role Russia played in meddling in our election in 2016. Well, the Russians have been very actively engaged in trying to meddle in European elections, and they tried to... Not only did he offer a $10 million loan to Le Pen's party in order to bankroll them, but a team of Russian hackers tried to intervene clearly at the behest of the Kremlin and hack into Macron's emails in a way similar to what happened to Hillary Clinton's campaign as a way of trying to embarrass him. But his team had been tipped off to this this threat by French intelligence, and they took some countermeasures that proved to be effective. And so Russia failed in its effort to intervene in the French election, and Macron won in the runoff against Le Pen by a resounding 66% to 34%.
Well, while we're on the subject of Putin, I have to ask you to share with our listeners a little tidbit you threw into your book that really revolves around Merkel's fluency in Russian and Germany's dominance in the European Union, and that in a sense it's thrust her into her role of interlocutor-in-chief with Vladimir Putin, and they had a meeting. And you share what happens at this meeting regarding a dog, of all things. But it tells a lot about how far this guy will go in Western Europe or any place else.
Well, very much so. He is a product of the KGB. He grew up in this culture. He had been a KGB agent in Dresden at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And Putin himself speaks good German, and Merkel, who had grown up in the Russian client state of communist East Germany, learned to speak very fluent Russian as a child. So they can communicate easily in both of their native languages. And because of this, I think Obama said, well, it's time we want to see Europe assume greater responsibility. So he said, Angela, I want you to handle the Putin account, particularly in dealing with Ukraine. So she had something like 70 conversations or meetings with Putin in the span of about a year and a half. And one of them, Putin showed his KGB training when it's been known that Merkel has a phobia about dogs. Apparently she was bitten as a child. And so when they were meeting in a small, in Putin's weekend dacha outside Moscow, they sit down and are drinking tea, and suddenly these two large Labradors come in and start prowling around. And of course, the chancellor is petrified, and Putin is smirking at her discomfort, and then says, oh, don't worry, they won't bother you. He said, but I will help you get over your fear. In fact, I want to make a gift of one of them to you, and you can take this dog back with you to Germany. She knew what he was up to because she was well aware of his KGB training. But when that story leaked out, of course, the German government officials who were traveling with her were furious.
I'm sure she turned down his generous offer.
Yes, I think she had a very easy time declining that gift.
This is Bob Custer, and I'm speaking with William Drozdiak about his book, Fractured Continent, which looks at the challenges facing the European Union and its 28 member countries. Let's talk about the European Union for a moment. One of its biggest criticisms, as you point out in your book, is that it lacks democratic accountability. Would you explain to us the structure of the European Union and why it's having such a difficult time here getting its act together?
Well, anytime you've got a superstructure put together by 27, 28 countries, you're bound to have some kind of a Tower of Babel effect where there's room for a lot of misunderstanding. So a lot of these national governments, while they wanted to create a headquarters for the European Union in Brussels, they also wanted to retain national government control. So, but there's been a growing outcry saying, you know, we need to have these institutions under some kind of democratic voting. So they, some time ago, they created a European Parliament to oversee the actions of an executive branch called the European Commission, which proposes initiatives that can be applied in all of the member states. And some of this is very good. It's kind of like our federal government proposing national legislation that affects all of the states, whether it be environmental guidelines or safety rulings on food and drugs, you know, things that will cross borders. So it's important to have this for the safety of our populations. But the effort to impose some kind of democratic legitimacy on these institutions has been difficult. One idea was to have the president of the European Commission directly elected by all of the 500 million people, but that would mean campaigning in different countries and different languages, and they've continued the practice of simply making that a position subject to political horse trading among the national leaders. And then there's the European Parliament, which has the pretension of being the voice of the people. But that is really a Tower of Babel because of the political dispute between several countries. It now rotates its headquarters among Brussels, Luxembourg, and Strasbourg, France. And so at great cost to the European taxpayer, they load up all their paperwork and their officials and they hop aboard trains, and every month they alternate between Brussels, Luxembourg, and Strasbourg. And, you know, it'd be like if the U.S. Congress were forced to pack up every month or so and move from Washington to Pittsburgh to have legislative sessions there before moving back. And it's just created a lot of chaos and a lot of unnecessary cost. And this has also contributed to the disenchantment that a lot of European voters have with the European Union.
Well, one of the reasons that the European Union is in rough straits, obviously, is the Brexit vote, the decision by British voters to leave the European Union. And you mentioned already that Cameron made a really bad move, a bad decision that angered many people across Europe, especially Angela Merkel. What's the biggest challenge that Prime Minister Elaine May now faces as she leads negotiations for Britain's departure for the EU? I mean, there were some there for a while that were asking if indeed somehow along the way this could be reversed, watered down, whatever. Where's this going?
Well, I think they're now only facing up to the magnitude of the task at hand. She's vowed that they will leave the European Union by March of 19. But that means they're going to have to negotiate their way out of a lot of bills that have to be paid, and then new trading arrangements, which are going to be very difficult to work out. And then there's a matter of what will Britain do? It's been subject to trade deals that the European Union has negotiated on its behalf and those of other members with the rest of the world. So that means Britain is going to have to negotiate hundreds of new treaties with the rest of the world, not in addition to making the arrangements for leaving the Brussels headquarters. So I think there's been some buyer's remorse in Britain. I don't know whether if there's been some talk about holding a second referendum, a do-over to see if they could reverse this, but But a lot of people say it's too late. The British voters have expressed their voice, and that that they've got to make the best of this. But I think it's going to be a decision that British people will regret for generations, and also it's going to have a serious impact in Europe. I mean, the Brits have the strongest military force in all of Europe, and if they are moving away from European defense, in addition to leaving the European Union, then that's going to harm efforts to have the Europeans take control of their own security, which is a real shame. I mean, let's not forget that the European Union project is one of the most noble experiments, I think, in history. I mean, this has ended centuries of warfare between France and Germany, and for five centuries, every generation of French and German young people were either preparing to go to war or were fighting each other at the cost of enormous bloodshed. And after two world wars in the previous century, they finally decided that nationalism is a deadly curse in Europe and we have to put this behind us. The European Union has been a resounding success in terms of spreading peace and prosperity among all these neighbors in Europe. But unfortunately, I think a new generation has come along that sort of takes it for granted. And I think they're going to end up regretting the possibility that it could all fall apart.
Chapter by chapter, you've documented this rise of nationalism, the separatist movements. And alongside of it, of course, you've pointed out that we have a president of the United States that seems to be interested in moving to more bilateral agreements and not multilateral agreements. And I guess the concern is, does not this give Putin a great opportunity to just move Russia back into Western Europe in ways that we may remember from another era?
Well, that's right. He's already doing that. We see him very actively engaged in Russian oligarchs who are loyal to Putin are buying up media properties in places like Romania and Bulgaria. They are using social media in devious ways to affect the politics in places like the Baltic states. I have a chapter there on Riga, the capital of Latvia, which because of half of its population is ethnic Russian. So you really have parallel information societies that half the population watching Russian language channels, the other half watching Latvian channels. They're getting different information, kind of like in the United States, those who just watch Fox News have a totally different view of it than those who are watching MSNBC or something. But in Latvia, it goes much deeper because the history is so bloody and terrible. So, you see a lot of Russian meddling, and Putin, I go back to his time in Dresden, in his own memoir, says, for me, the greatest disaster of the 20th century was the collapse of the Berlin Wall, and the loss of the Soviet Empire. So I think in his time in power, he wants to reverse that process, and I think if he gets reelected, which almost certainly will happen in the next few months, then he will continue to push ahead and trying to regain Russian control over these territories that were once part of the Soviet Empire.
Well, Bill, we've run out of time, but I want to thank you for your excellent treatment of Western Europe, Fractured Continent, Europe's Crises and the Fate of the West by William Drozdiak. Thanks so much for joining us today, Bill.
Okay, my pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
Next week, Brian Van Riet, author of Spoils. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you missed some of our recent shows, including my conversation with Craig Johnson, author of the best-selling Longmire series, you'll find them on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org, or download our free app from Google Play or the App Store to listen to previous interviews anytime.